oral history project interview given by me, Dr. Robert B. Coy. I'm doing this interview at my home in Suttons Bay, Michigan, in March of 1990. The beginning of this interview has to do with my childhood and education before coming to the University of Wisconsin. I was born December 17th, 1924 in Los Angeles, California. My father and mother were severely impacted financially by the Depression, and in 1931 or 1932, our family moved from California back to Victor, New York, where my mother's home was located. And I grew up there through high school, living in this small country village in the western part of New York State. When I was a junior in high school, I injured my back rather severely playing basketball, and this condition was diagnosed as spinal epiphysitis, and was treated by putting me in a plaster jacket for a year. During that year, I had, of course, very close contact with an orthopedic surgeon who was taking care of me, Dr. Haywood Hopkins, and grew to respect him very much. The summer following my release from the jacket, I worked as an orderly in the operating rooms at the Genesee Hospital in Rochester, New York, and again had very close contact with Dr. Hopkins, so that at the end of my at the end of that summer, I was 100% certain that I wanted to follow a medical career. In the summer of 1942, I started a pre-medical program with a major in biology at Williams College, and then took a three-year hiatus for World War II. I was a rather unenthusiastic participant, and came back in 1946 and completed my undergraduate work in 1948. I really enjoyed the work at college, and was very happy with a major in biology. I applied to a number of medical schools, and as luck had it, I was accepted almost immediately at the University of Rochester, and I almost immediately accepted their invitation. I can't remember now why I preferred Rochester over some of the other schools, but I think in retrospect it must have had to do with the fact that that was a hometown area, and I knew a good many of the people in the school, and it also was likely that I being married and having a child at the time was very conscious of the cost of medical education and thought that living near the family home would probably be less expensive than living elsewhere. Going to medical school at the University of Rochester was an incredibly pleasant experience. I remember only one instance in the entire 4 years at Rochester in which I was made to feel to be a stupid or lazy medical student, even though I'm sure there were many other occasions when that feeling would have been a reasonable one. Clearly, the person responsible for this attitude at the faculty towards students at the University of Rochester was Dr. George Hoyt Whipple, who was the dean and chairman of the Department of Pathology. Dr. Whipple was a Nobel laureate in 1931 or 1932 for his work on the pernicious anemia factor. Well, in my basic science years, I greatly enjoyed pathology. I don't believe I enjoyed it any more than any of the other basic science courses. And in my third year, I very greatly enjoyed all the rotations on medicine and surgery and pediatrics and psychiatry and so forth. It wasn't until the end of the summer of following my third year that I decided to go into pathology. And that was because during the summer following my third year in medical school, I had an opportunity to work at a state tuberculosis sanatorium in Maine, where I and another classmate were given huge amounts of responsibility for the care of some pretty sick people. And during that summer, I found that I was more irritated than anything else by being presented with clinical problems that I had no immediate way of solving or even managing, most likely due to the fact that I was put in a position of too great responsibility for the amount of clinical training and experience I'd had. In any case, I found myself spending more and more time with the pathology people in the area and talking with them about problems that were present in the patient population at the sanatorium. Following my graduation from medical school in 1952, I began an internship at Rochester and followed with 2 years of residency there. During the residency, I was increasingly interested in both research in the field of renal-like excretion of protein, and also interested in the teaching part of the pathology program. Students at Rochester were taught pathology largely by performing autopsies with residents and then discussing them and working them up at great length. I found this association with medical students to be a very pleasant one, and one from which I learned as much as the students did. So I was, although I had originally entered pathology with the notion that I would become a community hospital pathologist, by the time I had finished a couple of years of residency at Rochester, I was clearly headed in the direction of academia. In 1955, Dr. Whipple retired as chairman of the Department of Pathology, and I and a number of others in the department decided to leave the selection of the University of Wisconsin. Was due almost entirely to a meeting that Dr. Charles Yule, a professor of pathology at Rochester, had with Dr. Angevine, who was chairman of the Department of Pathology at Wisconsin. And Dr. Yule told Dr. Angevine that he had a young person looking for a junior position at an academic pathology department. Dr. Angevine invited me to come out and take a look at an opening he had. I was not initially attracted to it because I had hoped that I might find something open in the Pacific Northwest, but nothing was available, and so I accepted Dr. Angevine's offer to come out and look at Wisconsin as sort of a second best. As it turned out, I was very, very pleasantly surprised to find such a beautiful campus and such a fine university, none of which I had really suspected before going out there. I think people who go to school in the East grow up with a very dim appreciation of what is available out west. In any case, I went to Madison not really appreciating in any significant way what a great university it was or what a fine medical school it was. I went simply because I found the people and the locality very congenial and did not expect to spend more than a few years there, hoping that I would eventually move on to the Pacific Northwest. One amusing incident stands out in my memory of the time when I was deciding to come to Wisconsin. That was at the very end of our negotiations. I asked Dr. Angevine what my salary as an instructor might be, and he replied that it would be $7,500 a year. And I was shocked to hear a figure that low, and I said, "Dr. Angevine, I am married and have two children. I'll have to buy a home, and I don't know that I can get along with $7,500 a year." And Dr. Angevine smiled in a very kindly way and said, "Well, Dr. Coy, that isn't very much money, but you won't have to do very much work either." And so on that basis, which I think still is a very good basis for university pay and university work, on that basis I came out to Madison and I never regretted it. Correction, at the time I had that conversation with Dr. Angevine, I had three, not two, children. The next section of the interview format concerns the work I did at UW as Secretary of the Faculty and as Assistant and Associate Dean of the Medical School. I don't remember the exact date that Dr. John Z. Bowers, the Dean of the school, invited me to become Secretary of the Faculty. I believe it must have been about 1959. Dr. Bowers asked me to do this work. It was a new position and not very well defined, and I, at this point, a good many years later, don't remember a great deal about it, except that I was sort of a recording secretary for faculty meetings and also a sounding board for Dr. Bowers, who I believe was headed for the confrontation that led to his dismissal as dean. I think that he used me to some degree as a person off whom he could bounce his ideas about faculty affairs. I don't believe that I had any influence or any role in Dr. Bowers' decision to do any specific actions, but I think he enjoyed the relationship with me simply because I was not a major player in any of the negotiations he was engaged in. I do remember, not very clearly, meetings that were semi-regularly scheduled between John Bowers, Helen Bunge, who was the Dean of the School of Nursing, Hospital Director Ralph Hawley, and maybe there were others, but I remember meetings of that group occurring perhaps once a week over a fair length of time. I also remember that during his battle to name a new surgical chairman, that there were a number of, I would classify as younger, more idealistic faculty members who strongly supported his position, but also recognized that Dr. Bowers was, although a very bright and generally very pleasant person, was also pretty aggressive and pretty abrasive at times, so that his support was strong, but not, I would say, as fully developed as it might have been. In any case, I thought John Bowers was a first-rate dean, and his position was a correct one on these major matters, and I was a supporter of his position through the time that he was dismissed by the Board of Regents. The work that I did as assistant and associate dean fell into three general categories, beginning in about 1960 or thereabouts. I was active in the admissions field, and then over a period of time became active in student affairs, and finally wound up in the late 60s as the middle or the late 60s in curriculum committee work. The deans during those periods were, after John Bowers left, Phil Cohen was acting dean for a period of time, and then Jim Crow, and then Peter Eichmann became a full-time dean. The people with whom I worked during these years were so many that I can't possibly remember all of them, but some of the major players in these various activities were Hartwell G. Thompson, or Tommy Thompson, from the Department of Neurology, Art Siebens from Rehabilitation Medicine, Charles Lobeck from Pediatrics, Dave Graham from Internal Medicine, Bill Lewis from Psychiatry, John Benfield from Surgery, Warren Dennis from Physiology, and Bob Benjamin from Neurophysiology. Also very important in my work in these various offices was Ralph Hawley, and particularly helpful in admissions and student affairs work was the chairman of the Department of Anatomy, Otto Mortensen, who was also associate dean when I first joined the dean's office in the early 60s. should also mention Isabel Peterson as an extremely helpful person in the student affairs and admissions work. She had, before I came on the scene, been almost the only person involved with the administrative and student affairs and admissions work. And she was very frequently the first and only contact students had with administration, and that is, she was able to solve a great many student problems without any need to talk to faculty or deans about financial problems or personal problems or health problems, things of that nature. The interview format calls for a response to the question, where were my offices during this time? That is an interesting question because it brings into focus the difference between what was going on when I first came on the scene and what has later developed in medical school administration. When I began this work and through the time that I was active as an associate dean, I never had an office that was specifically allocated to this kind of work. I always used an office that adjoined my laboratory in the Department of Pathology. Some corner of my lab. It was not considered to be a major function of the dean's office and was not allocated space or budget or secretarial assistance or the major support services that are now routinely provided to an expanded office of the dean. It was a small and very informal sort of family-style dean's office in the early 60s and did not grow very rapidly into anything much more sizable until well after I left in 1972. I began doing admissions work during the early 60s when there were far fewer applicants to the medical school than there were places available for them. At that time we were admitting 80 students per year, and for several years while I was a member of the committee and later as chairman, there were empty spaces in the entering medical school class. One of the hot policy issues during that period of time was whether or not we should fill those remaining empty places with people whose college work did not predict success in medical school on the assumption that some of them would make the grade and those who did not would at least have had a chance. I oppose this policy strongly because I believed and still do that the medical school class should be limited to those who have a very high likelihood of success. Over a period of several years, the admissions picture changed quite remarkably. We had increasing numbers of applicants until the point where it became a very big job to review all the applications and select the students who were to be offered places in the school. This got to be a very difficult job because not only of the numbers of applications with which we had to deal, but also because our criteria for admissions were not very rationally developed, nor were they very firmly or specifically spelled out. For example, we had initially very little good data about the value of interviews for medical student for medical school applicants. And it wasn't until we had been at this work for several years that David Graham particularly had developed some actual data on the question, should we rely on the medical school admissions interview as a means of selecting medical students. Other issues that were considered important but not well or were not clearly decided were, should students who have a strong background in science be preferred over students who have a background in liberal arts? Another question had to do with what is the relative value of excellence in extracurricular activities as opposed to excellence in coursework, and how is motivation to succeed in medicine measured? All of these questions were debated at each and every meeting of the Medical School Admissions Committee, and I do not believe that they were ever answered as a that is, I believe those questions are still debated in admissions committees today. One very interesting aspect of the admissions committee's work in those days was the matter of admission to medical school of women. We had always, as far as I know, admitted women to the medical school, but had taken the position that they would need to be better than average students in order to succeed in the medical school environment. This position was supported by evidence in the form of very high attrition rates for medical students, female medical students. The female students had an attrition rate, as I remember, around 50%, compared with the male rate of something like 10%. So the committee took the position that a girl applicant should have a grade point average and an MCAT considerably higher than a man's in order to make reasonably sure that she would be able to graduate. As the numbers of students, student applicants increased, and particularly the number of female applicants increased, more were admitted. And interestingly enough, the attrition rate for the female students went down very dramatically as the numbers of female students in the class increased, which I think simply meant that as there was some sizable number, they felt less threatened by a hostile male environment, and could rely on each other for support that enabled them to complete the medical school curriculum without problems. The medical school's policy with respect to admission of black students was also a very major concern during the period I was active in admissions work. So far as I know, a qualified black applicant to the medical school had never been rejected in the history of the medical school. I do not believe there were any qualified applicants who applied to the medical school before the middle 60s. At the time I was active in admissions work, it was just becoming a major concern and issue for medical schools right across the country. And I took it upon myself to be sort of the cheerleader for this effort. I do not remember which year it was, but it probably was about 1964 or 65. A young black student dropped into my office and expressed an interest in attending the University of Wisconsin Medical School. He was a student at Tennessee A&I and was attending a pre-medical students meeting at Madison. He impressed me as a very bright and articulate person, and I encouraged him to apply, and eventually he did, and we were able to put together a financial aid package which was sufficient to meet his needs, and he entered the medical school. He was the first admitted black student in the medical school's history, as far as I know. He had considerable academic difficulty, but managed to overcome these and graduated, I believe, in 1969. His name was Walter Tardy, T-A-R-D-Y. I believe he is the first black graduate of the medical school, and he sort of led the way for larger numbers of black students in the following years. The Medical School Admissions Committee took the position that the number of black graduates would only be increased by providing an opportunity for students whom we believed were intellectually and motivationally competent to succeed in medical school, but whose academic records did not equal those of the white applicants. We, in effect, took a gamble and made it clear to the black applicants that they were taking a gamble in being admitted to the medical school. This was a matter of very great concern to the faculty, and there were very heated arguments on each side of the issue. I think in retrospect it is clear that if we had not taken these steps, the chances would be very small that the number of black medical graduates would not have increased significantly. On the other hand, I think it's also clear that the admission of black students who were not as well prepared as white students has made for very great problems for all parties concerned. Nevertheless, I believe that the position was a correct one, and I very sincerely hope that the eventual result will justify the social and emotional turmoil which accompanied these efforts. I should make it clear that although I've described myself as a cheerleader for this effort, I was certainly not the person who decided these issues. The medical school and the university at large is well known for its policies with respect to governance. The faculty does have the responsibility for developing admissions procedures and policies and curriculum and all such related matters. So in the end, the medical school faculty was the responsible entity for these policies, although, as I've said, I was in a leadership position. Each and every applicant accepted for admission to the medical school was admitted by a vote of the admissions committee, which precluded, I think, very effectively any opportunity for improper influence with respect to particular applicants by legislators, influential alumni, university administrators, etc., all of whom are at one time or another alleged to have influence with respect to medical school admissions, period. With reference to my work in student affairs, there were three major areas of activity. These were, first, student participation in faculty committees. The mid to late 60s was a period of very intense student activism, and student activist leaders ordinarily would approach me to express their views of how the world ought to be. The students in general believed that they had major contributions to be made in work done by the curriculum committee, the admissions committee, and a number of other committees. I did not have any problem with students being represented on the admissions and curriculum committee, and in some cases in committees to select deans or directors. However, I did not believe that it was appropriate to have student representation on faculty promotion and tenure committees or in most search committees for faculty or administrators of the medical school. A second area of activity in student affairs was concerned financial aid for medical students. At the time I began this work, the financial aid available to medical students was very limited. I believe it was something in the neighborhood of $2,500 a year that was available through a revolving loan fund, and my job was to authorize disbursements in the neighborhood of $50 to $100 for students who had emergency needs for travel or medical expenses or things of that nature. As time went on, the amount of money available increased very substantially due to federal loan programs and contributions by wealthy donors. particularly the alumni. At that point, it became possible to offer financial aid packages to students, which represented very close to the total amount needed for a medical educational program. And a number of students were supported to a degree that in the past would have been unthinkable. This enabled us to attract a number of very good students who otherwise would not have been able to complete medical school, but it also posed a substantial problem for them in repaying the very large amounts of money that were borrowed. A third area of activity in student affairs was academic counseling. This activity was frequently very discouraging because it involved students meeting, that is, meeting with students who were in academic difficulties. No matter how rigorous the admissions committee was in admitting students with what were thought to be substantial academic credentials, a number of students each year had academic difficulties and were made to either drop out of medical school or repeat years or courses and so forth. And it was my duty to discuss these matters with them and inform them of the actions of the academic year committees. Occasionally, the students would express the view that they really weren't interested in medicine to begin with and were relieved to be off on some other career path. But unfortunately, most of the students found this a very bitter pill to swallow, and it was not a pleasant task to work with them on their next steps. Maybe it was because of those experiences that I counterbalanced so enthusiastically by attending student beer and bratwurst parties and the faculty-student field days in which softball games were greatly enjoyed by both faculty and students. The third major area of activity for me was work with the curriculum committee. In 1965, I returned to Madison after a year away in Scotland on a sabbatical, and new dean Peter Eichmann asked me to lead an effort to study and possibly revise the curriculum. The faculty had voted that a study and leading to possible revision should be undertaken. The climate for change in curricular matters was very favorable in 1965. George Miller's book called Teaching and Learning in Medical Schools was very provocative and challenging attack on the traditional ways of teaching medicine to undergraduate medical students. There was also considerable activity and general discussion of concepts of family medicine as opposed to specialty medicine teaching. The need for increased numbers of medical graduates, as well as the need for medical graduates who are more patient-oriented as opposed to disease-oriented. And all of these considerations were superimposed on a bedrock of more traditional curricular concerns, such as is the material being taught relevant to medical practice, and is the teaching too oriented toward research as opposed to practical medical matters, and so on. Changes in medical education and in curricula were being undertaken in most medical schools across the country at that time, and the example being followed by a good many of us was that of Western Reserve University, where an apparently successful revision emphasizing integrated multidisciplinary teaching of subject matter as opposed to departmental or disciplinary oriented subject matter approach was being utilized. Our curriculum committee studied the existing curriculum at some length and reckoned its advantages and disadvantages, and then proposed to the faculty that the curriculum be revised with the basic change being a presentation of first year subject material by departments and presentation of second year material referred to as pathophysiology by interdisciplinary committees involving not only various basic science faculty members, but clinical departmental members as well. This proposal was not agreed to enthusiastically across by all faculty members by any stretch of the imagination. Many of the departmental chairmen and a substantial number of particularly older faculty members resisted the notion of loss of departmental control over disciplinary material very strenuously, and a series of faculty meetings was necessary to discuss the proposal at length and to hear all arguments pro and con. Eventually, the proposal was accepted by the faculty, but it was a quite close vote, as I remember it, and even though it was accepted by majority vote, it was not a generally popular revision. The implementation of that new curriculum was therefore very difficult and required enormous efforts by conciliators and innovators, particularly I think of Dr. Al Berman in anatomy, who made very major contributions to keeping the whole shebang from falling apart. As part of the curriculum revision package, the curriculum committee also proposed that the grading system be changed from a letter grade A, B, C, D, F system to a numerical grade 0 to 100 system. This was because the weighting of course credits varied substantially among the various disciplines, and so a minor variation in grading in one course, for example, from a C grade to a D grade, would amount to a substantial change in the year's academic credit when compared to a similar change in a course which carried less credit. This proposal also provoked considerable negative comment, and although it was accepted, it was not accepted as a uniformly good thing. I should note that in addition to faculty opposition to the curriculum change, there was considerable opposition expressed by students as well. Frequently, their opposition was exactly opposite to the points of view of the faculty, they taking the position that the curriculum changes were not, quote, radical, close quote, enough, and did not go far enough in the direction of making the subject material relevant to medical practice. In retrospect, it seems that those of us engaged in this kind of work spent the best part of several years jumping back and forth between the frying pan and the fire. But it was extremely interesting, and one did not lack for a variety of hot issues to discuss during the average working day. The next section of the interview format concerns the pathology department and the medical school. Although I was a full-time member of the Department of Pathology faculty and carried a full load of teaching and service responsibility responsibilities within the department, I probably spent only about half time as I was busy, approximately half time with activities in the curriculum or admissions or student affairs fields. Although I had several small research grants and spent a fair amount of time, particularly early on, in research involving renal pathophysiology, my research production was pretty limited, and I found that my interests really were stronger in the field of teaching and administration than in research. I did enjoy it, and I greatly admired the production of other people on the faculty who clearly were very able and talented researchers. But I believe I had just too many irons in the fire to do a first-rate job of research. From my point of view, Dr. Murray Angevine, the departmental chairman, was an ideal chairman in that he permitted all of us in the department to find our own way toward whatever goals we established for ourselves. He rarely offered criticism or advice unless it was solicited, in which case it was available and very helpful. The other members of the faculty that I worked closely with were Drs. Joe Lalich, Stan Inhorn, Henry Pito, Henrik Hartman, Gabby Zeron, and Ricky Valdivia. Joe Lalich and Dr. Angevine were the senior members of the department and were clearly the most influential in departmental governance. My recollection of departmental staff meetings is that when there was a question to be settled about salaries or promotions, we generally voted that Dr. Angevine should use his best judgment, and we would go along with it. In general, it was a very harmonious group of people to work with, and although there were occasional spats, none of them were of any major consequence, and I don't remember any very serious problems involving staff at my level in the department during the time I was there. I'm sure there were problems involving the clinical laboratories and things of that nature, but I simply did not get involved with those. Another activity I should mention in the department was my work for the State Crime Laboratory. Dr. Angevin, I believe, recognized that I needed a little additional income and offered my name to the crime lab as a person to assist them in medical legal work. So I wound up doing a fair number of autopsies at the request of the crime lab and doing all the work that with the courts that resulted from those autopsies. That resulted in what at the time seemed like a very generous addition to my university salary, but in retrospect was pretty small potatoes compared to what the pathologists in the community were earning. The next section of the interview format calls for some discussion of the medical school deans who I worked with. I think all I care to comment about is the general nature of the relationship between me and Drs. Cohen and Dr. Cohen and Dr. Crow and Dr. Eichmann. In general, in each case, while they regarded the work I did as important and necessary, I believe that they felt that this was secondary importance compared with other hot issues before them in their offices. I'm thinking particularly of such matters as a faculty practice plan, selection of departmental chairman, recruitment of new faculty, relationships with the legislature, relationships with central administration and the Board of Regents. All of those things, I think, took precedence in their minds, and understandably so, over the work that I was doing. In effect, I believe there was sort of an unwritten and unspoken agreement that if I didn't plague them too much, they wouldn't bother me, which I think was a reasonable working relationship and one that I was, generally speaking, quite comfortable with. The next section concerns facilities. about all I can comment on is that the facilities in 1955 were considerably different from what they are now. I think particularly of the library, which was then in the basement of the SMI building and was accessible through a spiral iron staircase that had a sharp projection on it, which was usually covered with a chunk of foam rubber. And if the foam rubber wasn't there, it was about even odds that you'd get a concussion trying to do any library research. Since then, of course, things have dramatically improved, and I think that the building program at Madison has been a pretty successful one. The next section of the interview format concerns university-wide governance. Although I served on several university-level committees, such as the Allied Health Committee for Physicians Assistant Program and the Nursing Dean Search Committee, I don't remember enough of the specifics concerning their activities to make a contribution about their work. In 1965, I believe it was, Vice President Bob Clodius asked me to work with a small group formed by President Fred Harrington to look into the possibility of developing a medical school in Milwaukee. This committee included the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee campus, Martin Clotchy, the dean of the graduate program there in Milwaukee, Bob Clodius, and Wally Lemon. Wally was the point man for the facilities development program on the Madison campus, and a very able and knowledgeable member of the university staff. We began this work by doing a fairly extensive study of the Wisconsin physician manpower and trying to formulate some idea of the needs of the state in the future. At the same time, we spent a lot of time in Milwaukee investigating the capacities of the undergraduate and graduate programs at UWM and the willingness of a number of the hospitals in Milwaukee to cooperate with the University of Wisconsin in developing clinical training programs. At that time, the Marquette University School of Medicine was an integral part of the parent university and a private Catholic run school. They were in considerable trouble at the time on two scores. One, their operating budget was insufficient for maintenance of a first-rate program, and their physical facilities were no longer adequate for a teaching program. With those conditions obtaining, it is not surprising that Marquette University was pretty quick to state their opposition to the University of Wisconsin investigation. Marquette reacted very vigorously and very quickly, stating that a second medical school in Milwaukee was not needed, and what was needed was state financial aid to the existing medical school. The gist of the University of Wisconsin position was that if there was to be state funding, it should be for a state-operated medical school, either a new school, or if Marquette wished to give up their school, the university could consider operating it. Marquette Medical School responded by revising its charter such that it no longer had any direct relationship with the parent Catholic university, and had a governing board entirely selected from the public at large. This, they believed, was sufficient change in their governance to make it possible for the legislature to provide state funding for a public purpose. I.e. Medical education in a private but not a church-operated medical school, public medical school. Well, these two groups dug in and unwilling to give ground on their respective positions, the governor of the state appointed a task force on medical education to arrive at some solution to the problem of medical education in general, but more specifically the problem in Milwaukee concerning the funding of a medical school there. This task force was chaired by Don Slichter from Milwaukee, Dean Eichmann, and Wally Lemon from the University of Wisconsin, Dean Joel Kerrigan, and John Cully, the provost of Marquette University from Marquette, and a number of state senators and citizens in general. The task force staff was headed by Harry Spindler from the Coordinating Committee for Higher Education, and I served on that staff along with Warren Exel from the University Department of Administration. The task force issued its report in December of 1967. Included in the recommendations were the following: that the medical school at Madison be increased in size so that it could accept 160 medical students per class, and that Marquette Medical School be increased to 160 first-year places, and that a new medical school be developed in Milwaukee with a class size of 100 students. This new medical school was to be operated by the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. I think it was clear, even at the time of the recommendations, that what the task force had done in essence was to recommend that the state fund the Marquette Medical School, and that that funding plus the cost of increasing the funding for Madison so that the class could be expanded to 160 places would use up all of the available money available through the legislature for medical education in the state, and would therefore in effect put any development of a University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Medical School in total limbo. As far as relationships with central administration are concerned, I would have to say that nowhere in the work that I did, either within the medical school or as part of a university committee, particularly in the Milwaukee Medical School project, did I sense any antagonism or difficulty in working with the people or the policies of the central administration. I think you should bear in mind that again, that I did not deal with questions that would concern Dean having to do with budgetary matters and promotion and tenure matters that could cause difficulties with at the interface between the university central administration and the medical school. I simply did not have any role in those areas, so that my appreciation of any potential difficulties would be pretty dim. The final section asks for comments on women and minorities at the University of Wisconsin. I've already discussed under the part devoted to a description of the activities of the admissions committee, the work we did to increase the numbers of women and black students in the medical school. I neglected to mention anything about opportunities for Jews. I find that interesting because it really never occurred to me that there would be prejudice operative at that level at Wisconsin. I am not being a Pollyanna about the matter of religious prejudice, but it just did not occur at Wisconsin, at least during the time that I was involved with admissions activities. There certainly were no quotas of any sort for any group. this point, I should like to add the names of two people with whom I work closely on many of these different projects. One is Dr. Mark Hansen, and the other is Dr. Arvin Weinstein. And also add the name of Dr. J.M.B. Bloodworth to the faculty in the Department of Pathology. Now for a final comment. Reviewing what I've said in the last hour or so, it seems that much of what was exciting and zesty and challenging in my time at Wisconsin was characterized by a struggle of us young Turks against the old goats who represented the status quo. Now that I'm in the category of the old goat, I simply hope that the new young Turks on the scene at Wisconsin are having as much fun harassing the old goats as I did.